Hi.
Hi. So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode number 96, The Iliad by Homer. And this specific translation that Tom and I are using is the most recent one by Emily Wilson.
Meninae de tea, peleia deo achilleo solo menen, hemuria caiois algie tecin, bolas diptimus psychas aidi proiapsen heron. Autos de gloria teu cecunesin uio noisi te passi. Dios de teleto bule, ex hude ta prota diastete nerisante atrideste anaxandron, cae dios Achilleus.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we take a thorough look at one piece of literature that we have both read, perhaps it's an epic, and determine whether it is required reading. So I am here. I've got my really special shield with many images glazed upon it. And with me is my right-hand man, Tom Panarese.
Hello.
Hello. We made it.
Yeah.
Through this epic.
This is a big one.
Yes. And we are unsure right now whether this is the last episode of our series or not. If you have any regrets. I will say that it's been a while since I've chosen a book that I knew would agree with you.
This is true.
So perhaps I can be given some grace, and now you'll just have a rest period for a while again.
I'll try.
Yes. Well, we actually last saw each other in person.
Mm-hmm.
How's life been for you since Baltimore Comic Con?
Busy. Very busy. And it's just, hopefully it will start to let up at some point, but there's just a lot going on and a lot of stress for everybody. And yeah, so.
I feel you. I think, I don't know if a school teacher will ever say, oh, you know, I'm not that busy.
No.
Does that state of being ever exist?
June?
Yeah, I know. Seriously. After grades are in and comments have been posted or whatever.
Yeah.
So. Understandably. Yes. Yeah. Well, of course, teaching one cannot scoff at, but also one should not scoff at people, soldiers, leaders in war, in an epic battle, and that's what we're going to be looking at today. And I will say that I think this might be the one episode we've done that could be covered in like a semester or a year-long course.
Yeah.
If I'm thinking about other ones, because I mean, sure, like Jane Eyre and some of these like classics could be pulled, but I feel like this one, because of how substantial it is it's tough to talk about in a couple hours. So I just want everyone to be aware of that it's probably very clear to us that we're going to be, you know, jumping around and skipping some things. And I'll use this time to at least plug that this is my season on Dear Reader season 3. So if you would like, you can jump over there starting in November, where I'll do a deep dive into the source material and then look at its adaptations. And that's over at a competing podcast network, the Fire and Water Podcast Network. So in a way, but Tom has done this before, in a way, double duty, eases my load. But, you know, like I said, Tom's done it. We've all done it.
Yeah.
It'll be okay. So, yeah, we're doing the Iliad, and I'll just start at the beginning with what is your, I mean, I've heard you speak of this, but what is your history with this epic?
I was assigned this in my freshman year of college. The course was called, I was in the Loyola College Honors Program. And so we had a four semester kind of mega course that started with the ancient world and ended with the modern world. And it was a mix of different humanities. And this was taught by a classics professor, and it was the ancient world. And his first assignment was, it was like, read like the first four books or these four books of the Iliad. And so there I am. Yeah, I just did not understand a single thing of what was going on. I was completely lost through most of it. I threw it across my dorm room at one point. Mm-hmm. We had a test, and the only reason I really did all right on the test was that a bunch of us from the class got together at in one of the study lounges or something, one of the available like group rooms in one of the dorms, with the Iliad, whatever notes we had, and the Cliff Notes, and just had a several hour long, like three hour long or so study session. And it was a little bit easier to understand then, but yeah. And I had a very, very tough first semester of college. And this was only the beginning. So, but yeah, no, I loathed this.
So basically it's like a traumatic time that I'm bringing back.
Yes.
Okay. And you said, was it the whole thing?
I want to say we didn't read the whole thing. We read parts of it, but it's been almost 30 years, so I can't remember.
Okay.
I remember what translation it was, because I actually came across a copy of it in our book room when we were cleaning it out last year or so, or a year or two ago, because I remember what the cover looked like. And the translation was by, I believe his last name was Lattimore, and I want to say his first name was Richard.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's fitting that we're doing it since I am almost done. Well, when I go to work, I am down the street from Loyola.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you are.
So that, yeah, it's so fitting. So I will say that I think my history with the Iliad very specifically begins with Troy the movie. I was aware, because I love the classics and I love mythology, I was aware of different heroes and things like that. But when Troy came out, which I actually really like that film, actually. Mm. And I know that people have problems with it, and I'll definitely be doing a deep dive on it. But that was, I just really loved how we were able to see this epic as well as it could be done on screen at that time, and to see some of these godlike heroes, you know, Hector and Achilles. And that film, you know, a big thing is that there's really no gods or superstition involved in that.
Yeah.
So they have to go around that, which is, of course, a question that I'll ask. But that was really the first time that I was like, oh, wow, this is actually pretty cool. And then when I got my first job and I was supposed to teach AP Latin, which at that time was Virgil, many passages, I think it was like over 1500 lines of the Aeneid. Mm. And in my mind, I thought, well, the best way or the best summer assignment for AP students would be to read the Iliad, but I wasn't about to make them read all 24 books. So I definitely had excerpts or picked particular books that had the most relevance to Virgil and the Aeneid. And I, of course, I think I read the whole thing just so I could be with the students. I never assign something that I won't do myself or don't know myself. And that translation was Robert Fitzgerald.
Okay.
Which, yes, I do like as a translator. And so I guess that was probably the last, so what, 2010 maybe? Fall of 2010 was the first and only time that I had read the Iliad. But certainly, yeah, repeated watching of Troy because that was like a boon that the students got at the very end of the year. They could watch that. And then with no sex scenes, of course, and a permission slip had to go out. And I will say in my final year at university of undergrad, I was in ancient Greek because I needed that for my major. And we translated some passages, in particular the opening of the Iliad. And I think it might have been sort of watered down Greek to make it easier for students, because I mean, it's not easy. That language, Greek, in my opinion, is actually more difficult than Latin. But I just remember being able to talk about this opening with the muse, the invocation of the muse, and then speaking of the anger of Achilles, which is really cool to be like looking at the Greek and translating it. So I guess that's basically my full history. And then knowing that there was a female translator that was going to be tackling this, which I thought was so intriguing because of all the really the misogyny that goes on there, and you know, how would she treat some of these situations? Or, you know, now there's this really strong belief that maybe Achilles and Patroclus were also lovers. So it was really interesting to consider, oh, what is Emily Wilson going to do? And then I ended up getting this. I think you got yours first. I remember you like.
I did, and I deliberately bought it because I have been using her translation of the Odyssey for years in class, and I really like it. So I was like, well, if I really like her translation of the Odyssey, maybe I will give this a try. So I bought it, but I hadn't read it until you suggested it for the show.
Yeah. It was just sitting pretty on your shelf.
Pretty much,
you pull it down, yes. And I was waiting because I knew I was moving. I didn't know where I was moving. And I felt like I did not need another 2 to 3 pounds to pack. So I was waiting, and then someone asked, can I get you a housewarming gift? And I was like, I'd really like the Iliad. And so she got me that, which I'm very thankful for. So I think that basically catches us up with that particular question.
Yeah.
So I will say that the synopsis, when I get to that, will be actually pulled from Emily Wilson's notes, which were extremely helpful. I did not, you'll have to, I guess this could be a question now, whether you refer to those notes. I didn't until there were occasional moments where I had some questions as to why something was happening. And it was good because I went back and I was like, oh, she actually does mention like there's something strange about this particular thing. But she also has lovely summaries of each of the books. And so I'm just going to pull from that. Did you refer to any of these end notes which were at the end of the book?
Not really. I skimmed them here and there, but I really didn't know. I just kind of read the book straight through.
Okay. And I will say, also taken from her, is the structure of this book. So it's very much, I'll just call it an epic. It's very much broken up into three acts. So book 1 through 9 begins with the quarrel between Achilles and Agamemnon, and then culminates in the embassy between them, where Achilles still refuses to help out. And he's like, no, even though you offer all these things to me. And then act 2 is books 10 through 16, where the Trojans are growing closer to burning the Greek fleet. And then Patroclus, or Patroclus, some, you know, different pronunciations there, enters the fray and he's killed. And then the final act, book 17 through 24, is how Achilles and his feelings are transformed, really, following the death of Patroclus.
Yes.
So this is our structure that we will follow. But I do have to talk a little bit about Homer. And I will say that, because I'm like using some Dear Reader notes here, that there's a lot of background as to why this war even starts. And I feel like that might be outside of the purview of this show, because we're really just focusing in on the literature as it happens.
Yeah.
Besides some context to get us in there. But again, I'll just say that I will go into that on Dear Reader, really talking about, you know, why would Helen be to blame? Why was Helen even someone that is to be mentioned? How did Paris come to be with her? Like, all of this stuff is stuff that I will discuss. But it goes back there's a lot of drama that goes on. So I will say that this background on Homer comes from Britannica, so it's like a reasonable source.
All right.
So not much is known about this poet that we call Homer. We do know that he lived at a time of significant transformation in Greek history. Historians best estimate that when he was composing his poems, both the Iliad and the Odyssey, was probably sometime between 725 and 675 BCE, or before Common Era. So he probably lived between or in the 8th and 7th centuries. Mm-hmm. So that means that he was living near the beginning of what historians call the Archaic period, or often called the period of classical antiquity. This is really when there was a development of the Greek city-state system, Greek trade routes were being expanded, and then the emergence of the simplified Greek alphabet. So Homer was really living and writing at a time when Greek civilization, as we typically think of it, was just coming into being. And so that's why he's pretty significant, because he played such a noteworthy role in this. Our story takes place in the Bronze Age, and this is a time when bronze was a primary type of metal in use. The people who populated Greece during this age were known as the Mycenaeans, and this civilization collapsed sometime around 1200 BCE, and they left behind the earliest Greek writings, which were composed in a script called Linear B. Man, this is like back in middle school kind of history. I remember these sorts of terms. Homer most likely set his epic around this time, because this is a period when heroes were imagined to have been bigger, stronger, and more godlike than anyone that was then living. And I kind of think about Beowulf in a similar fashion, like what set it here with these type of people that were around then. Homer doesn't merely seek to tell tales of gods and godlike warriors, though. He's also developing his material in significant ways that help shape the moral universe of present and future Greek culture. So he uses history, even though part of it might be fictionalized, to create, or help create, really, Greek civilization and then culture that we now associate primarily with the period of classical antiquity. There is, in terms of realism, there's much debate whether such a war could have actually existed, primarily because of the size of it, that the scale that is described and the actual space that would have been allowed. Troy is on the western coast of Anatolia, and it's believed to be about 74 acres. So that's not too sizable for the amount of armies and action that we're actually described as we're reading. So obviously, and I think this is very similar to Beowulf, which had lasting effects, I guess, in literature, is that the Iliad and its impact is really something that cannot be measured, not only with its themes, characters, and narrative techniques, but also, I think, wartime literature. Like, I think it really sets the stage for what we might see following. You know, I think about, even though I don't care for him, Ernest Hemingway. I feel like that sort of literature, or even Red Badge of Courage, or anything else, I think, Western literature-wise, that may not have existed without this kind of setting the stage for what wartime literature actually looks like. Obviously, we have Virgil's Aeneid that's going to follow from this, half the size of the epic, and really the last half, oh, we did this on this show, so this is like me being redundant, but the final half of that is very much following the war and how it's set up, even though he's in a different area, similar to the Iliad. And then the first half of the Aeneid is like the Odyssey. We certainly have references in Shakespeare's tragedies, like Hamlet and Macbeth. We have, you know, War and Peace, if we think about that. We have modern adaptations like The Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller. So just the influence is far-reaching, and Homer himself as an author, I think, will probably never be forgotten. Whether or not he was one man or multiple, whether he was a blind poet or not, Yeah. So I think, again, you could go on and on. This is like a whole class. I feel like that sets the stage enough. Is there anything that you think I left out that would be conducive to our audience?
I know that when I talk about the Odyssey with freshmen, I talk about how in many ways this was performed.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it might have been a story that people already knew in some regard. So there was like the audience was built in. I've just always been fascinated by the fact that two of the most famous parts of the Trojan War are neither the Iliad or the Odyssey.
Yeah.
The Trojan Horse is mentioned in the Odyssey in a flashback sort of way where a minstrel or singer sings the song of Odysseus and the Trojan horse before Odysseus reveals himself at the court of Aeaeus, Alcinous. And I think Helen of Troy's, I think it's kind of mentioned here too, but it's not portrayed. And I know that just kind of looking into a little bit of this, when I was just kind of bouncing around Wikipedia about it, is that it's thought to be kind of part of a, maybe not Homer hadn't written it, but like you can gather parts of this and a bunch of other fragments of things into sort of a cycle that is incomplete because of what has just been lost to time.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, just to hop on that, that this would be performed and it would be performed with music, because this has an actual meter to it. Yes, I'm not going to perform anything. Maybe I could maybe find something like a clip online, someone doing the opening potentially.
I'm sure there's somebody there, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And I will say, obviously giving context too, which is probably going to pop up in the synopsis, that this is coming at the end of the war. 9 years have passed.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't like, oh, they've just decided to come together and take back Helen. They have been there.
Yeah, and it's a period. I think the length of time this takes place is a mere matter of weeks, or am I mistaken? It's not a very long period of time.
No.
Within the course of this epic that these events take place, and then it's not even the end of the war because it's a 10-year long war.
Right.
So.
Yep.
There's more after this.
Yeah, it doesn't end with the destruction of Troy or anything. Yeah. If you're looking for background, if you're just going to do this, you don't want to get into Dear Reader, I will just say maybe look up The Judgment of Paris, because I think that's kind of the go-to to figure out how Helen became a factor at all. I think that's mainly the thing to know about. But, you know, a question that I do really want to ask, it's going to be a guiding question for my own show, is whether Helen is actually to blame. There are certainly some interesting passages. So I will be asking that question. But I think, yeah, I'm ready to give the synopsis. Are you ready?
Sure.
Book one. The allied Greek armies have been encamped on the shore of Troy for just over 9 years, besieging but failing to capture the city and sacking neighboring towns, killing the men, looting, and enslaving the women. The most valuable items of loot, including the most highly prized enslaved women, are shared out among the most powerful warriors in the Greek alliance. One of these enslaved women is the daughter of a priest of Apollo, who prays to the god to get his daughter back. The god responds by sending plague to the Greek camp. The prophet Calchas explains to the Greek leaders that the priest's daughter needs to be returned to her father. Agamemnon, the most powerful member of the Greek alliance, agrees to return her, but insists on taking another trophy woman for himself from Achilles. Achilles, robbed of his trophy and dishonored, is furious and complains to his mother, Thetis, a sea goddess. The goddess asks Zeus to restore her son's honor by ensuring that, as long as Achilles absents himself from battle, the Greeks will lose in battle, and vast numbers of Greeks will die, thus demonstrating that the Greeks need Achilles to win. Zeus agrees with a nod. The gods on Olympus enjoy a feast, and a squabble between Zeus and Hera is quickly resolved, thanks to the intervention of their son, Hephaestus. Book 2. Zeus sends a personified dream to Agamemnon to tell him he can take the city of Troy. Agamemnon tests the troops' morale by telling them to sail home, which they try to do. Odysseus and Nestor help rouse the men for war, and Odysseus beats a subordinate warrior named Thersites, who speaks out against the expedition and Agamemnon's leadership. Athena rouses the fighters. The narrator catalogs the leaders of the Greek ships assembled at Troy, as well as the most prominent horses, and the Trojan leaders and their allies. The scene echoes a mythical event not told directly in the poem, the beginning of the Greek expedition, when the ships gathered at Aulis to set sail for Troy. Book 3. Paris challenges Menelaus to a duel, and the two sides agree that the winner of the duel will keep Helen as his wife, along with the treasure taken with her from Sparta. As the warriors prepare, Priam and Helen sit on the wall of the city, and Helen names and describes various Greek leaders, about whom Priam is suddenly curious, after they have been besieging his city for the last 9 years. In this duel, Menelaus gets the upper hand, but Aphrodite rescues Paris, scoops him from the battlefield, and puts him in his bedroom. Aphrodite forces Helen to join him there against her will, a scene that echoes the original abduction of Helen by Paris, not told directly in the poem. Agamemnon insists that the Trojans must return Helen, since Menelaus got the better of Paris. Book 4. The gods hold a banquet and watch the humans. Hera and Athena long for the destruction of the Trojans, and Hera promises Zeus that he can destroy 3 of her favorite cities if he permits the sack of Troy. They send Athena to spur the Trojans to violate the truce, which she does by encouraging Pandarus to try to shoot an arrow at Menelaus, which he does. The arrow strikes its target, but Menelaus's armor protects him, and Machaon, the doctor, tends his wound. Agamemnon, presenting the Trojans as treacherous oathbreakers, rouses the Greeks to fight. Hostilities resume, and there are many gory deaths on both sides. Book 5. Athena inspires and strengthens Diomedes, who is one of the best Greek fighters, and tells him he can strike Aphrodite if he sees her on the battlefield. The Greek leaders kill a number of Trojans. Aeneas is almost killed, but is rescued by Aphrodite. Diomedes attacks Aphrodite and cuts her wrist, so she drops Aeneas, who is rescued by Apollo. Aphrodite goes sobbing to her mother, Dione. Dione and Zeus tell her to stay away from war. Paean heals a scratch. Diomedes attacks Aeneas, but Apollo scolds him, saves Aeneas, and puts a phantom of Aeneas on the battlefield. Urged by Sarpedon, Hector rouses the Trojans to fight for the phantom. Apollo tells Ares to encourage the Trojans, which he does, and the Trojans slaughter Greeks. Athena and Hera ride in an impressive war chariot onto the battlefield to help the Greeks. Athena joins Diomedes on his chariot and urges him to attack Ares, and they wound him. He complains to Zeus, and Paean heals his wound. Book 6. The Greeks start to gain the upper hand. Hector, following the advice of his prophet brother Helenus, returns to the city to urge the older women to pray to Athena at her temple and to say goodbye to his family. He visits his mother Hecuba and gives her the instructions but refuses to stay for a drink. He visits Paris and Helen, urging Paris to return to battle. Finally, on the city walls, he meets his wife Andromache, along with the enslaved nurse and his baby Astyanax. Andromache begs her husband, on whom she depends for everything, not to return to the plain, but to adopt a safer strategy, remaining on the wall to defend against any possible Greek invasion. She reminds him that his death will lead to the fall of the city, the death of their son, and her own enslavement, along with that of all the other Trojan women. Hector rejects her suggestion on the grounds not of military strategy, but of personal prestige, insisting that it will be humiliating for him to be seen by the Trojan public doing anything except leading the charge against the Greeks on the plain. The baby cries at his father's frightening war helmet, and the parents laugh. Hector meets Paris at the gate, and the brothers go out to the plain. Book 7. The arrival of Hector invigorates the Trojans, and killing intensifies. Athena and Apollo plan to slow the conflict by arranging for a duel between Hector and one of the Greeks. Menelaus volunteers, but Agamemnon talks him out of it, and Telamonian Ajax is appointed by lot as Hector's adversary. The fight is evenly matched. Night falls suddenly before either gains the upper hand, and the two exchange gifts of friendship. Nestor and Priam call for a pause in fighting to bury the dead. The Trojan Antenor tries for a diplomatic solution to the war, the return of all property, minus Helen, in exchange for peace, but the Greeks reject the offer. The Greeks begin building fortifications around their encampment to defend against Trojan attacks. Poseidon, who built the walls of Troy with Apollo, feels threatened by this ambitious project, but Zeus comforts him with the promise that, after the war is over, the gods will obliterate the wall. Book 8. Zeus holds up his cosmic scales, and the fortunes of the Greeks sink down. Hector dominates the battlefield, and the Greeks are on the run, until Hera inspires Agamemnon to encourage the Greeks to fight back. Despite this, Hector drives the Greeks back to their ships. Hera and Athena want to interfere to help them, but are restrained by Zeus, in accordance with his vow to Thetis. Only Achilles can stop the Trojan advance. Book 9. Agamemnon tells the Greeks that the war is hopeless and they must sail home. Diomedes and Nestor oppose him. In a council meeting, Agamemnon acknowledges that he was deluded in dishonoring Achilles and offers to give him many lavish gifts and to return Briseis. On the advice of Nestor, the Greeks send Odysseus, Ajax, and Phoenix to convey the offer to Achilles. Achilles, who is singing and playing the lyre when they arrive, hosts them with a meal. Odysseus conveys Agamemnon's offer, but Achilles vehemently rejects it. Phoenix pleads with him, tells the story of his own quarrel with his father, and reminisces about Achilles' childhood with Phoenix himself as his caretaker. He goes on to tell of Meleager, who was angry because of a quarrel with his mother and refused to help his community during a siege, but finally relented, and of the Prayers, goddesses who symbolize the importance of healing the damage done by anger and delusion. Achilles invites Phoenix to stay the night, saying he will postpone his final decision until morning. Ajax reminds Achilles that acceptance of inadequate compensation is normal even for the killing of loved ones, and implicitly reminds him how much the Greeks need him. Achilles says he will rejoin the war, but only once Hector begins to burn his own ships. Odysseus and Ajax return to the Greek camp, and Odysseus gives a gloomy report to Agamemnon. All sleep. Book 10. Agamemnon, troubled about the Greeks' military position, cannot sleep and rouses the other leaders. They have a nighttime council meeting and agree that Diomedes and Odysseus will go on a spying mission into the Trojan camp. Meanwhile, Hector, who is also awake, calls the Trojans to a meeting. He sends an ill-favored but swift-footed man named Dolon, Deceit, to spy on the Greek fleet, promising to give him Achilles' horse if he succeeds. Odysseus and Diomedes capture Dolon and question him. He gives them useful information about the layout of the Trojan camp and the presence of the Thracian king Rhesus, who has just arrived at Troy with valuable horses. Dolon begs for his life, but Diomedes slaughters him, and Odysseus dedicates his weapons to Athena. They reach the Thracian camp, and Diomedes slaughters a dozen men, finally killing Rhesus. They take the horses and chariot and gallop back, aided by Athena. Apollo alerts the Trojans to the Thracian massacre and the theft of the horses. Diomedes and Odysseus return in triumph to the Greek camp with the chariot, horses, and spoils. They wash off the blood, sit down for dinner, and make thank offerings to Athena. Book 11. The armies prepare for battle. Zeus sends blood to rain from the sky. Agamemnon slaughters many Trojans, but then is wounded by Coon, the son of Antenor, and has to leave the battle. Hector rouses the Trojans, while Diomedes and Odysseus kill several Trojans. Diomedes attacks Hector, but fails to kill him. Paris wounds Diomedes in the foot, and he has to leave the battle. Odysseus, alone among the Trojans, stands firm and succeeds in killing several, but is wounded by Socus. Menelaus and Ajax escort him from the battle. Machaon, the doctor, is wounded by Paris and rescued by Nestor. Ajax kills many Trojans, and the Greeks gain ground until Ajax, outnumbered, begins to withdraw, although he keeps the Trojans from the ships. Eurypylus joins him, but is wounded by Paris. Achilles sees that the Greeks are being wounded and sends Patroclus to find out whom Nestor is taking from the battlefield. Patroclus goes to Nestor's hut, and Nestor explains how badly the Greeks are doing and how many are wounded. He then reminisces about his own military exploits, urging Patroclus to counsel Achilles to rejoin the fighting at this crucial time. Or, if Achilles still refuses, Nestor suggests that Patroclus should join the fighting himself, clad in Achilles' armor to reduce Trojan morale and allow the Greeks some respite. On the way back to Achilles, Patroclus meets the wounded Eurypylus, takes him to his hut, and treats his wound. Book 12. The narrator tells us that after the Trojan War is over, Apollo and Poseidon will knock down the Greek wall and restore the landscape of the plain as it was before. The trench and wall block the Trojan chariots, but Hector orders the Trojans to advance into the Greek camp on foot. An eagle flies from the left, the unlucky side, and drops a snake among them, which Polydamas tells Hector means that their mission will fail. Hector dismisses his concerns, and they charge ahead over the trench. Sarpedon and Hector break through the wall, and the Trojans surge through. The Greeks are routed and flee to their ships. Book 13. Zeus turns his gaze away from the war, and Poseidon rushes to Troy to encourage the Greeks, first disguising himself as the prophet Calchas, and then speaking directly to try to shame them into fighting. Hector fights with extraordinary zeal and rouses the Trojans. There is intense fighting, and Hector, aiming for Teucer, kills Amphimachus, grandson of Poseidon, rousing the god's wrath. The god inspires Idomeneus, who, along with Meriones, attacks the Trojans and wounds Deiphobus. Menelaus kills several Trojans. The assault of the two Ajaxes diminishes Trojan morale. Hector summons Paris and tries to rouse the Trojans, but an eagle flying on the right side of the Greeks suggests that they have the dominant position. Book 14. The Greek leaders scan the battlefield and realize how many are wounded or dead. Agamemnon wants to go home, but Odysseus scolds him. Poseidon inspires the Greeks. Hera forms a plan to distract Zeus. She dresses herself with maximum attractiveness through a visit to Aphrodite, then seduces him. Afterwards, he falls asleep. Hera tells Poseidon that the field is clear, and he gives further encouragement to the Greeks. Telamonian Ajax knocks Hector unconscious with a boulder. Greeks slaughter Trojans in large numbers, and they flee towards the city. Book 14. Zeus wakes up and is angry, but reassures Hera that Troy is still destined to fall. Iris is sent to tell Poseidon to leave the battlefield. Apollo energizes Hector and the Trojans and eventually joins them in the fight. The Greeks flee, and the Trojans beat down the ramparts. Intense fighting breaks out around the ships, defended by Telamonian Ajax and Teucer with his bow. Eventually, Hector reaches the Greek ships. Book 16. Patroclus begs Achilles to let him follow Nestor's suggestion from Book 11, to enter the battlefield dressed in Achilles' armor. Achilles agrees on the condition that Patroclus must turn around once he has driven the Trojans from the ships. Patroclus arms while the ships begin to burn. Patroclus and the Myrmidons drive the Trojans back, and Patroclus slaughters numerous Trojans, many of whom are trapped in the Greek trench. Zeus pities his son Sarpedon and wants to save him, but Hera reminds him that none of the other gods would approve of saving a mortal. Patroclus kills Sarpedon, and both sides fight for his body and his armor. Zeus wants Patroclus to die for his son's death, but first allows him to slaughter many more Trojans. Patroclus ignores Achilles' advice and pushes to the gates of the city. Apollo pushes him from the gates. Patroclus kills Cebriones, Hector's charioteer, and amid the fighting for his body and armor, Apollo knocks Patroclus over, making the borrowed helmet fall off, breaking the spear and loosening the borrowed breastplate. A Trojan named Euphorbus spears the now unarmed Patroclus, and Hector makes the final kill. With his dying breath, Patroclus predicts the death of Hector at the hands of Achilles. Book 17. The Greeks and Trojans fight over Patroclus's body and armor. Hector drives Menelaus back and strips the armor. However, with the help of Telamonian Ajax, Menelaus returns to stand guard over the body. Hector puts on Achilles' armor in triumph and fights Ajax. There is a long battle over the body. Apollo spurs Aeneas to rally the Trojans. Meanwhile, Achilles' immortal horses realize that Patroclus is dead and begin weeping. Zeus inspires them to run with their driver, Automedon, into battle. Book 18. Antilochus runs to tell Achilles about his friend's death. He is devastated. Thetis and other sea goddesses emerge from the sea to mourn with him, both for Patroclus and for Achilles himself, who will soon die. Achilles insists that he is eager to die, but wants first to kill Hector. Thetis tells him to return to battle. Only once she has fetched a new immortal set of armor for him. Achilles shows himself to the Greeks, but does not fight. This is frightening enough for the Trojans that they flee, and the Greeks bring Patroclus' body to safety. Polydamas advises Hector to withdraw, but Hector rejects his advice. The Greeks mourn Patroclus, and Achilles says he will never go home again. Thetis goes to Hephaestus, the craftsman god, who makes a beautiful new set of armor for Achilles, including a marvelous shield that depicts two cities, one at war and one at peace. Book 19. After Achilles puts on the new armor brought by Thetis, he calls an assembly. Agamemnon blames his previous behavior on Delusion, the daughter of Zeus, and on Zeus himself, but reiterates his willingness to give the lavish set of gifts to Achilles that he promised earlier in Book 9, and to return Briseis, all of which he does. Briseis mourns Patroclus, who is kind to her. Achilles refuses to eat, although Odysseus insists that the other troops need food before battle. The gods feed Achilles on ambrosia. Achilles mounts his chariot, and his horses speak to remind him that his death is near. Achilles angrily replies that he already knows. Book 20. Zeus tells the gods to join the human conflict, to ensure that Achilles does not sack the city, which is more than he is destined to achieve. Gods of Olympus and of the waterways around Troy line up against one another. Achilles searches for Hector, Apollo urges Aeneas to attack Achilles, they taunt each other and fight. Achilles almost kills Aeneas, but Poseidon rescues him. Achilles kills many Trojans, including Hector's brother Polydorus. Hector tries to battle Achilles and is almost killed, but is rescued by Apollo. Achilles rages and slaughters more Trojans. Book 21. Achilles forces half the Trojans into the river Scamander and clogs up the streams with corpses. He takes 12 boys alive. He encounters Lycaon, whom he captured on an earlier occasion and allowed to live. Now, Lycaon again begs for his life, but Achilles kills him, reminding him that Patroclus is already dead and he himself will soon die. The river Xanthus / Scamander rises up against Achilles, forcing him to flee across the plain. Hera sends Hephaestus, god of fire, to fight the river in flood, and the river submits. The gods fight amongst themselves. Priam sees the carnage and orders the Trojans to come inside the city. Meanwhile, Apollo distracts Achilles, first by sending the Trojan Agenor, and then by taunting Achilles himself in the guise of Agenor. Book 22. With most of the Trojans safely inside the city, Achilles chases the false Agenor until Apollo reveals himself. Hector is the only Trojan remaining outside the gates. Priam and Hecuba inform to come inside, but to no avail. Achilles approaches and Hector runs. They race around the city three times, until Zeus holds up his cosmic scales and Hector's destiny sinks down. Athena appears, disguised as another of Hector's brother, Deiphobus, to make him think he has a companion and therefore a chance against Achilles. He stops running and the two warriors face each other. Hector asks Achilles to ensure that the victor return the victim's body to his loved ones, a suggestion that Achilles angrily rejects. Athena disappears and Hector realizes that the gods have led him to his death. Achilles kills him and boasts over his corpse, which he drags back to the Greek camp. Andromache, who has been preparing a hot bath for her husband, sees him dragged dead in the dust and wails for her husband, her freedom, and their baby son, who will soon be killed. Book 23. Achilles tries to desecrate the body of Hector, but the gods keep it fresh. Achilles lets his men hold a funeral feast for Patroclus, but he himself refuses to wash off the blood from his body. When he falls asleep, the spirit of Patroclus appears to him and asks for their bones to be interred together. Achilles tries to embrace his beloved dead friend, but the insubstantial spirit slips away. The next day, the pyre burns, and Achilles burns the 12 Trojan captive boys and dogs and horses, as well as the body of his friend. The day after that, Achilles holds a series of athletic competitions to honor Patroclus. The first is the chariot race, which Diomedes wins because Eumelus, who originally had the lead, gets his yoke broken by Athena, who prefers Diomedes. Antilochus, through some shady tricks, comes in second. Eumelus's bad luck and Antilochus's cheating arouse anger, but Achilles smooths things over and everybody ends up with a prize, including the loser, Eumelus, and the ingenious cheat, Antilochus. The other events are boxing, wrestling, foot racing, weight throwing, and archery. In each case, all competitors receive prizes of greater or lesser value. The games show that victory is the result not only of talent and training, but also luck and divine favor, and they offer a model for how a group of ultra-competitive people might be able to share wealth and power without deadly quarrels. The final competition, spear throwing, is due to include Agamemnon, but Achilles gives him the prize without asking him to compete. Book 24. After the games, Achilles is still overwhelmed by grief for Patroclus. He continues to abuse Hector's body, although the gods undo the damage he does. The gods debate whether to have Hermes steal Hector from Achilles, but Hera, still fuming about the judgment of Paris, blocks the plan because she wants to see the Trojans humiliated. 12 days later, the gods agree that Achilles must give Hector back to the Trojans. Thetis goes to tell her son he must release the body. Iris tells Priam to travel through the enemy camp at night to retrieve his dead son. He does so with just one elderly companion. Hermes meets them on the way and guides them through the camp. Priam kisses Achilles' hands and begs for the return of his dead son. They weep together, Priam for his son and Achilles for Patroclus and for his father, Peleus, whom he will never see again. Achilles tells the story of Niobe and of the two jars of Zeus. Achilles agrees to give the body back and they eat together. Priam asks for 11 days of truce so that the Trojans can gather wood to cremate and lament for Hector. Achilles agrees. Priam sleeps outside Achilles' tent and is woken in the night by Hermes, who advises him to escape before dawn with the body, which he does. When Priam returns to Troy with the dead Hector, he is seen first by his daughter Cassandra. The Trojans prepare a funeral for Hector, and three female family members mourn for him in turn, his wife Andromache, his mother Hecuba, and Helen, his sister-in-law. The poem concludes with the end of Hector's funeral rites. So, Tom, we made it through that epic synopsis. What?
You're finally unmuted.
Yeah, I know. What do you think about? Did you enjoy this better, I guess, than you did before?
Well, I didn't throw it across the room. Believe it or not, and I think it might have been being a little older, and I think it certainly was Emily Wilson's translation. This was a lot easier for me this time around. There are certain points of it where I was kind of zoning out, but there are other, and there were other parts where it came in where I was a little more familiar with it. I would say that I did enjoy this. I still like the Odyssey more, and maybe that's just because I'm very familiar with it at this point. But no, this was good. It was better than I thought it would be.
I really liked this. So I think, like I said, I like Robert Fitzgerald as a translator. Mm-hmm. I feel like my state of mind that year might not have been, I don't know. I mean, it was either my first or my second year. So, you know, I might not have enjoyed it as much. But I thought that this was really well written. I typically skip over introductions, but I was super compelled by what she was saying in her introduction. And the ease of reading what was happening, I thought, it was super clear to me. And I thought that she did a beautiful job, which it's tough. Like she talks about in her introduction, like you have to make a decision whether you're going to be, you know, overly literal, or are you going to make it like more understandable? And also like, are you going to make it into a poem, that sort of thing? And I felt like maybe with a couple exceptions of when people went on these sort of segues of let me tell you a story, and I had to go back to figure out the point of why he was even telling this story to begin with. Like everything, I think, came together really wonderfully, and I thought it was very beautiful. And I think, you know, whenever I read The Odyssey, I'm like, you know, this is okay. Like this is enjoyable, but I don't have as much passion for it as you do. And I think I just like, I go towards the Iliad a bit more. And I don't know if this is like bias because there's obviously like an Aeneas connection to it.
That's true.
But I just like it. I don't know. I like it a bit more. Yes, obviously there are these lists of captains and where they're coming from and lots of piercing under the nipple, et cetera, et cetera. But I really liked it. And I think Emily Wilson did an amazing job. I don't know if I'd be saying I loved it as much, maybe if it were somebody else, but I'm glad that we have this, that this exists for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. One last thing on the Odyssey. You have to remember I've been teaching the Odyssey for the last 8 years.
Yes. So and that changes things.
Yeah, it does. It does.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's so more accessible and it flows really well too.
Yeah.
And I was burning through about a book a day, and that was a really good pace to read it, because even if I'm like not completely remembering parts of it, because again it's just like some of it I was like I had to go back and kind of like remember what was going on, but a book a day is a good pace because it allows you to pause and not rush through things. Because this is not the type of book that you can really speed read or rush through.
Right.
So giving it its space and giving it its time, I think is a really, really important thing when you come to read, this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yes. I was also doing a book a day and you could also sit with things because I would read it before I went to work. And so I would kind of consider some of the things that happened and make notes in my head. But yeah, I enjoyed it. And also just some weird things. All the rocks that were being thrown that seemed like boulders. There's a scene near the end when Achilles finally says, like, yes, I will take the gifts that you're offering. And they slaughter a boar. And a man picks the boar up and throws it into the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me happy for the rest of the day. Because I thought it was so silly. But
yeah,
no.
Yeah, and I read it on my lunch break.
Oh, okay. So, there you go.
Yeah, for a couple sometimes on the weekends where I needed to catch myself up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So. Well, here we are. We made it.
Mm-hmm.
So I do have questions broken down kind of in arcs, I guess. And
yes.
I'll start off with like a big question, but how do you feel like this does? I mean, I spoke about how I think it sets the bar. It's the originator of wartime literature. Would you agree with that statement? Do you feel like, yes, when I read For Whom the Bell Tolls or something like that, that I can see things pulled from here? And that, like, it's brutal. There's ugliness that goes on here. Some people, I think, show more humanity than other people. Like, Ajax goes a little crazy and just, like, chops a guy's head off, which is, like, a bit barbaric at the time. How do you feel, like, realistically, this worked as wartime literature?
I agree with you. Not only is it an ancient text, but this isn't something obscure. You know, like you said, it gets referenced over and over, and people pull from this throughout literary history. And the Trojan War, it's not completely a starting point for civilization. You know, there's other things. I want to say that like the Israelites in Egypt predates this, but I don't come for me. I don't know my ancient world timeline. but I mean, think about how many ancient works have some sort of war and or conquest, because there's a lot of the Old Testament has fighting and war. And there are others in India and things. So when we're talking about Western literature, I believe you're right. I mean, it's this sets the bar, and really there are works that approach that bar or that take from it. We've talked about the Aeneid before, which is another one that's like really up there. Mm-hmm. And then you get into down the centuries, and you talk about other. I haven't read a ton of war literature, so I can't speak to all of it. But then, like, you know, you don't get much of a sort of quote reset of the bar, but in another direction, in the anti-war way, until you get to World War I and you get to like All Quiet on the Western Front and stuff like that, which is like the kind of the setting the bar for the protest novel. And I think this still is seen. You see this in so many of the swords and sandals epics of Hollywood, like Troy and such. You see this in the way that you have. You mentioned Beowulf, and you have that idea of Hector and Achilles facing off against each other at the end is, I mean, how many times have we seen that in somewhere or another context where there is a hero and there is an, I wouldn't call Hector a villain, but there's two opponents on each side and they have to face off against each other. And yeah, it certainly fulfills that purpose.
Yes. Yeah. I don't have much to add from that, except I'm just glad that it doesn't beautify war or romanticize it, which
yes,
maybe in a, I was going to say to a certain degree, maybe Gone with the Wind does, but even like there are definitely scenes that you can see like, oh, this is the horror of war. Cause there's a lot of romanticization of like, you know, the South and what the Confederacy was and everything. And there's none of that here. It's just totally brutal. And there's much death and there's grief and anger over comrades being killed. And it leads to more death. And yeah. Ooh. I'm happy that it exists, though, because I think that we wouldn't have a lot that we have now that we consider great wartime literature.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe some people forget how brutal this can be because they think about the heroes and they think about the gods intervening and everything. And they might skip over a lot of these battle sequences because to a certain, like, they honestly go through the bronze and, you know, the rings of the shields and piercing under the nipples many times, mm-hmm. or the thighs or whatever. Like it does, it's happening over and over again, but who's to say that that's not real war? Like people are dying in this way. And I think it also brings home the fact that we have this list of, well, we have a main character roster, and then you have a list of captains that might pop up here and there, and you might have a highlight of somebody. But I think with all this death, you also realize and remember, oh, but there are other people there too.
Yeah.
There are other, like the grunts, the infantrymen that are beholden to someone else, like a client of someone else, and they had to go because their lord went. And I think we forget about them until we read these sequences. So I appreciate that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty epic opening. I'd like to read it from Emily Wilson's mouth. And then my question is, you know, why does it begin this way? Why does Homer choose to do this? Not only in terms of Achilles, but why not begin in the beginning, you know, at year one or landing on the shore? So it begins, "Goddess, sing of the cataclysmic wrath of great Achilles, son of Peleus, which caused the Greeks immeasurable pain and sent so many noble souls of heroes to Hades and made men the spoils of dogs, a banquet for the birds. And so the plan of Zeus unfolded, starting with a conflict between great Agamemnon, lord of men, and glorious Achilles." Which I love that she says cataclysmic wrath. Mm. Oh, so yeah, why why start in this way? Why focus on Achilles, like really making him into our main character, which is a little nuts because we don't see him for a significant portion of this work. And then he comes in and he's really the main focus towards the end. And then as a, you know, a secondary question, why not? Why start year 9 and not year 1?
I'll take the second one first because I was just thinking about this, and I was thinking about stories that we see in movies that we see or books that we see about other wars that are more recent than the Trojan War. World War II and the American Civil War come to mind. And with World War II, there are a lot of things that just focus on one aspect of it. So there's not a lot of world, you know, not every World War II book starts with, I don't know, Hitler taking over various parts of Europe and then invading Poland and ends with Nagasaki, you know, or something like that. It doesn't, it's too big of a scope. And it might focus on individual people or battles or things. And I think of something on the order of the Civil War, and like, you will just get things about the Battle of Gettysburg, right? Which is one part of a much larger conflict. So I think it's just kind of establishing that particular tradition. And who knows, he might have been like, we only know so much about the history of this and what he, you know, what his situation was coming up with this. Perhaps he was like, you know, perhaps a lot of people had told these stories and he was like, I want to tell this one, you know, like, I don't need to tell the whole war. And you're going to hear the story of Achilles. Now, Achilles is the hero. I mean, he is the mythological figure, right? I mean, he was, wasn't he the, he's a demigod, if I remember correctly, right?
Right. Dipped in the river Styx.
Yeah, with the heel, which we don't get until actually his death, which I believe is at the hands of Paris. Is but somewhere between the Iliad and the Odyssey again. It's not in here. But he was a mythological hero. He was a demigod. He was a Beowulf in that sense, right? Where there's something very Hercules about him. So, or Heracles, if you're going Greek. So I think that, you know, that would have been what an audience would have been really interested in. And they would have seen him as one of the major heroes. So like, let's hear his story of this heroism. Yet Homer's like, I'm going to give you that, but I'm also going to give you a little bit of kind of the realism of it or the other side of it and not constantly glorify the man.
Right.
You know, he kind of takes Achilles off the pedestal in an effort to make him a little bit more human.
Yes. And I mean, real world issues at that time where his honor was offended.
Yeah.
Because I know some people think that he is kind of childlike, you know, pulling this tantrum or being petty. And I think you could say that, but there's all, like, he doing what Agamemnon did, which was take his take Achilles' war prize for himself once Agamemnon had to lose his own in order to appease the gods. I mean, that was pretty disrespectful, especially for someone who is as important and well known as Achilles is. And I think narratively it's good to take him off the table for a bit because you can then focus on other people. Because I think when Achilles is there, which definitely happens in that last act, everything is about Achilles.
Yeah.
You can't, he's just such a big personality that you're not going to, the lens will not go to some other part of the battle. It's going to follow him around.
Yeah. Well, and if also, if there is this argument between Achilles and Agamemnon, and Achilles basically spends a large portion away from the field or in isolation, constantly going and seeing him in isolation quite frankly boring. So you need it to be entertaining, and you need him in the background while the others, we can focus on the war and what's happening, and that has things is more engaging.
Yeah. I would also say starting with book 9 and not 1, I think things are certainly starting to heat up. Everyone has gotten comfortable in where they are because it's been so long, which is why I think some of this stuff has started to happen. I don't know why the priest decides then in year 9 to demand his daughter back. that was something that I wasn't too sure about, because that's what really is the catalyst for all of this stuff. But really, if they landed on the beach, like, that can be kind of exciting. But then they're digging a trench, they're setting up, they're building a wall. It's like, yeah, all of these minutiae that maybe we're not as interested in, whereas now it's almost like the climax of the war.
Yeah, he loves minutiae, though. He does that in his other poem. And what's interesting about this is a very straightforwardly told story. There's not a ton of flashback and significant portions taking place during her time, but it's beginning as epics do in medias res or medias res. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, because it's beginning in the middle of a war, well, toward the back end of it, but you know, it's there's a lot that's come before it. And we're picking up where things had already happened, and we have to just kind of go forward. And we don't really get that much flashback to the beginning, whereas others do.
Absolutely. Okay, I will move on to Agamemnon in particular, and mm-hmm. just what you think about this character, and specifically what type of leader you see him as.
He is interesting because there's so much ego in this entire epic, and a significant amount of it is his. And I know that, like, when he returns home, he's like murdered. I mean, I think he's a very staid leader, and he certainly knows how to have command a large portion of people. And he's commanding a lot of other kings too, right? Like Odysseus and Ajax and those, they're generals on the field, but back home they were also kings. So I think he's got a good amount of strength as a leader, but I see a little bit of hard headedness about him as well.
I did not think that he was a good leader in the beginning. Not only because of this, well, what he did to Achilles, which I guess is his prerogative. Like, he can do what he wants.
Yeah.
But I think he should have foreseen what was about to happen, and that you are about to offend your greatest asset in this war. And then it continues because he has a dream. And then he decides that he is going to test his army by saying, let's go home. This is too much. Let's go home. To see if they are actually steadfast and stick with him. And I thought, what sort of weird backward strategy is this? And then when they're all lined up, he decides to go through all the leaders and offend them. Mm. By basically saying, you know, insulting them in some way. And I thought, this is terrible. I think culturally, it kind of made sense. So there's this idea of like a sense of shame, which is different than our shame, the modern shame, which is bad.
Yeah.
But a sense of shame is like it prevents you from doing something that would bring dishonor upon you.
Mm-hmm.
So he's kind of calling upon that. But I just feel like once you're lined up, like they're ready to go, why are you doing this? What is this, you know, set to prove? And I think he does change as a character and a leader towards the back end.
Uh-huh.
And I think he does actually recognize his mistake, because when he's quote unquote apologizing to Achilles, I don't actually believe it in the beginning. But then I think when he's actually remorseful at the end and seems to be a better leader, I don't know why he underwent this. Maybe because it was so scary and close to having their ships burned and losing. But I kind of saw two different Agamemnons in this epic.
It's interesting how Shakespeare in Macbeth does something similar with Macduff and Malcolm in Act 4, before they are head-to-head to Scotland to take down Macbeth, where he does this thing instead of like, oh, let's all go home. His thing is like, I'm loyal to myself and not to Scotland. And then Macduff is like, then I'll kill you too. And it's like, aha, I was testing your loyalty. And so it's interesting. I wonder if it's something that Shakespeare on some level was pulling from. But I agree with you. I mean, this is very, very messy in the beginning. And it doesn't become clean at the end, but it is, once you get past that point where they are trying to burn these ships and everything, and then Achilles finally, you know, comes to, it becomes way easier to see. Mm-hmm. And Agamemnon falls into the role he was supposed to be in, you know.
Yeah. Well, the other big players in here, and of course we'll I'll be talking about Hector as well and Patroclus, yeah. But the gods and goddesses are huge, huge players in here. What are your thoughts on their involvement? Do you think that this epic either suffers from it, or the gods and goddesses add to it with this kind of supernatural element? Thoughts on those gods and goddesses?
As somebody who's read plenty of Wonder Woman,
oh,
yeah, I didn't mind the gods and goddesses. I actually thought that was intriguing because I just love I love how the Greek pantheon bickers with each other and petty with each other, because it's not something you get in the Abrahamic religions, right? You know, God the Father is not bitchy. You know, he's wrath, vengeful. There's the wrath of God, but that's a totally different thing than Zeus being, Hera being mad at Zeus, and Athena and Ares just arguing with each other, and these people essentially possessing people on the battlefield so they can fight against each other, or standing behind them and advising them and stuff. And I like that idea that the gods were kind of their playthings, and it shows the gods in a light that's not so great, whereas mythology makes them seem, except for maybe Zeus, really, really good.
Right.
Zeus is terrible. But yeah. And all those, what's interesting is that, like, so I was just thinking back, and I don't know if he starts with if he starts just with the Iliad, or if he actually goes back to the beginning. And I want to say he does go back to the beginning, but Eric Schanauer did a series, he's a comic book writer and artist, and he did a series for Image called Age of Bronze that is essentially the Trojan War. And I do believe he removed all the supernatural elements of it. And I think he starts with the start of the cause of the war. Because there, I do remember reading part of it where they're trying to get Achilles to fight, and that his mother hid him among women in the palace or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Odysseus who, you know, kind of smoked him out there, which is ironic considering Odysseus pretended to be crazy.
Right.
And almost ran over Telemachus. And you know, when he swerved, Agamemnon was like, aha, I knew you were faking. So I can see it being done both ways. I don't know if Eric Schanauer ever actually finished Age of Bronze, but I do remember reading some of the graphic novels at the library, and I enjoyed it. But I really like the gods in this. I think it's fun. And I think it might be even a little criticism of the gods on his part, which I'm all for.
Yeah. And I think there's definitely politics going on too.
Oh yeah.
Because there's partisanship here. They are not neutral. The gods and goddesses have their favored sides, though that does not necessarily prevent them from having favorites or protected or honored humans on the opposite side.
Yeah.
So you'll see somebody protecting someone, even though they might hate that particular side. I mean, the mythology and those people I really like. It's super complicated. I think it's funny you said, you know, Zeus is not the greatest. And no. Juno is so, or Hera. Hera is so complex. And I want to, like, be on her side because of what she has to put up with her brother / husband. But also, like, she's super petty here.
Mm-hmm.
And then even Minerva, Athena, who's my favorite goddess in the pantheon, being super mean and saying, like, don't attack anyone. I think she was talking to Ajax and said, or unless it was Diomedes, but she said, you know, you don't attack any of these gods unless you see Aphrodite. Then you can harm her. And then poor Aphrodite gets hurt. But I especially appreciate Apollo and how he is guiding arrows and is really helping them out. And then It's also interesting, Aphrodite, even though I do feel bad for her in some scenes, I don't think that she should be dragging people away from the fight, because that just causes more issues. Like, the war could have stopped in that scene, or the one-on-one battle between Paris and Menelaus, but he gets injured, and then she basically whisks him away to Helen's bedroom. And she does protect her son as well, and I know she drags him away from the Diomedes fight. But yeah, the politics, I think, are super interesting. The plots that go on, Juno, Hera herself, you know, coming up with these plots to sleep with her husband and then have like a sleeping drought so she can do some stuff while he's sleeping. And that whole imagery of her suiting up for battle, but it's suiting up to seduce her husband, was really intriguing. And what's awesome about this epic narratively and historically is that it goes back. So obviously you have the Judgment of Paris, which involves the three goddesses, and two of them are offended. And then also Troy being built by gods, and then some of them being offended. Like, that's why Poseidon's offended. So it's so steeped in everything that would be so weird to not have them.
Yes, Poseidon's such a baby. it would be weird to not have them. I also love the fact, and it comes up here a few times and in other epics, I love how the most powerful force, or the most powerful of the gods of the fates, because one of the biggest things in classical literature, especially Greek literature, is you cannot escape your fate. And there's a lot of manipulation that's going on to make sure to see if somebody can win or not. But in the back of their minds, I think these gods know who's going to win and lose. So it's a power play among themselves, almost for clout or standing, even though perhaps Aphrodite knows Troy is going to fall. Cassandra certainly knew, and you know, so that, because they're kind of parrying for Zeus's favor in some way or another. And if you know these things are going to happen, well, it's, I just got to at least put on a good show for it, you know. And I've always loved the fact that the fates decide everything anyway. So now you are just, it is a bit petty squabble,
right? Yep. And there was a large portion of a particular chapter, I wish I knew which chapter it was off the top of my head, or book, where Zeus actually foreshadows everything that's about to happen.
Yeah, I remember.
And this was before Patroclus put on the armor. Like, he knows everything that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you can direct things a little bit. You can delay. But yeah, if something specific is being foretold about someone. And we know from, you know, Achilles, like, his fate had not yet been kind of solidified, because it was very much dependent on his decisions, whether he would live old to an old age or die in this way. But yeah, I mean, the sisters are pulling the threads out for sure. So I will move on to women, since I was talking about Hera, because she sometimes is terrible to other women, sadly. But what is the role of women in this epic? How do you feel like they were represented when you saw them? And then how do they interact with men, or how are they treated by men, I'll add?
This is tough, because the goddesses get more time than human women.
Yeah.
There are times where I forgot there were women with the Greeks. The Trojans, of course, yes, because they were in their own city. So you get a little bit more of that. This is very male forward. And I mean, Greeks was a very patriarchal society, so I'm not surprised. Yeah, like, some of them don't seem very significant. And I was hoping to see a little bit more of the mortal women, and see if they had more of a role, but perhaps they just simply didn't, and there was nothing to really embellish there. And then there's Helen, which I would imagine you just want to talk about in a separate question, where we could talk about now, because I know she gets a lot of blame for the war. I think sometimes, or maybe often, that's not coming from a place of understanding what happened, and more of a place of misogyny. And I don't know if it's on Homer's part or if it's just on our society's part. But I've always kind of bristled at the idea that I've actually heard people slut shame Helen of Troy. And I'm just like, that's not how I interpret it to happen.
Yeah, and I feel like it's a... I don't know if it's the Barbara Streisand effect. I don't know if it's the Nelson Mandela effect. I don't know which one is used properly. But I think that, which we can, yeah, maybe I shouldn't go into this yet. But just, I think it's gotten distorted. Because from my reading of it, it doesn't seem like Helen's mentioned, but mm-hmm. is it really her fault?
Paris goes back to her at one point. Yeah, but yeah, it's...
It's not, well, she doesn't even, it doesn't seem like she likes Paris. Mm-hmm. Frankly, from how I was reading it. But women, yeah, I think I see them as mothers to fret and mourn. And then slaves. Slaves yeah. that are just items, basically, that are prizes or to be traded or sacrificed, I guess, if the need may be. So not well. Not well. Mm-hmm. There are some people that care for them, I think. We have some characters. So the fact that the priest really wanting his daughter Chryseis back. Patroclus, it's clear that he probably cared for, was kind to the women in the camp because of how much the women of the camp mourn when he's dead. Mm-hmm. Priam is somebody because he actually has conversations with Helen and treats her like a human being. So I think they're an object, but they're also used as a device, I think, to show the character of certain men as well. But yes, it is interesting about the gods. I think there are still times, even though, you know, Juno, Hera gives some back talk to Zeus, and I think even Athena does to her father, that sometimes he'll put them down as well, which, I mean, that's his... his domain of power is king of the gods, so I guess that's his right and his prerogative. But yeah, they do seem to have more agency than others do, but then they'll also go after themselves, because I mean Aphrodite wasn't protected at all. They kind of called her a wimp. So yeah, so I guess we can just go to Helen. How do you feel like she's represented? Did you feel like it was her fault in reading this?
I've never felt that it was her fault. So I've always been on her side because she's taken against her will, essentially, from Menelaus. So she makes a few appearances here. I'm misremembering. She seems just like a reasonable person who seems a little bit truly sad because she's in the situation that is not... not what she would have ever wanted or something. But I don't know if we get enough of her to really have a real idea of who she is. Yeah, or maybe I'm missing it.
Well, no, I've been kind of marking as I was going scenes with Helen and everything. Uh-huh. One of these big scenes, I think, is with Priam. And this is in book 3. I'm on page 63. And Priam wants her to sit near him and kind of go through the important characters of the Greeks, which works both for the reader as well.
That's the roll call. Yeah.
Yeah. But then in line 210 says, "Glorious Helen answered, 'Father-in-law, I love you and respect you. I wish that I had chosen painful death the day I came here with your son and left my bedroom, kinsman, late-born precious daughter, and cherished group of woman friends.'" I just feel like she did not want to be here.
Yeah.
There's another 71 through 73 is when Paris comes back. And I will say, so this is on 71. Aphrodite is saying, like, "Paris is calling you back. You goddess, why do you want to trick me in this way? Will you keep leading me to yet more cities in Phrygia or in fine Maeonia if any other mortal takes your fancy?" Yeah.
Well, and Aphrodite's response is interesting. "Glorious Aphrodite, furious, said, 'Stubborn girl, you must not make me angry, or in my rage I will abandon you and start to loathe you with as deep a passion as I have loved you as my friend till now. I shall devise a strategy to make you loathed and abhorred by both the Greeks and Trojans, and you shall die a dreadful death.'" So it's interesting to see that, you know, again, that the whole idea of the pettiness of the gods.
Yeah, and she was, like, she has zero agency. Like, she's just this object that was fought over. She had no will to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
On 146, which is book six, there's a conversation between Hector and Helen. Brother-in-law, I am a source of fear and a source of evil strategy, a dog. I wish that at the start, right when my mother gave birth to me, a cruel gust of wind had borne me to the mountains or the waves of loud resounding sea and swept me off before all this could happen. I wish I had shared a bed with someone better, a man who understood the condemnation his actions would incur from other people. And that goes on. So I don't blame her. I mean, obviously 9 years have passed, so we do have to, like, keep that in mind. So maybe she was happy and now, like, she realizes, oh no, this is actually a bad situation. But I just feel like even when, and I'd have to look for it, and I don't think I have the time for it, other people had, on the Greek side, had mentioned her, but do not mention her in as wrathful a way as we would have imagined it to be. I would say that Paris takes more of the blame, and Hector, every time Paris is in the same room with Hector, Hector goes at him, basically calling him worthless, and Paris just has to take it. So I feel like, at least in this translation, I think it's more apparent that Paris is at fault here. It's just because of, I think, the culture, both in ancient times as well as modern, we are going to blame the woman for infidelity.
Yeah. No, I think that's incredibly accurate. And it's interesting to have Hector have those scenes so that there's an honorableness about him, even though he is on the other side of the conflict, I guess. Or though, I don't know, like, it's hard because Homer gives a good enough amount of screen time, page time, to the Trojans as the Greeks. So this is not the Greeks are the good guys and the Trojans are the bad guys, so to speak, right? There's honor on both sides, and this is just a war that took place and such. And Hector is a great example of that because he is a heroic character in that sense, or at least he has that sense of honor.
Right.
That is heroic.
Yeah. Do you want to talk more about Hector?
Sure. Yeah, because you were asking if he's fighting for the same things as Achilles and Agamemnon. And I honestly think that Hector is fighting for the honor of the city and to protect the city.
Yeah.
I never got the sense that he was, like, because Achilles, when Achilles finally goes into battle, he's messed up because his love has died, right? Agamemnon, I can't get a read on why he's doing this, other than the fact that I know that one of the reasons they all go to war was they all basically had come to an agreement that they had each other's backs had something like this happened. So Agamemnon kind of had no choice because he and Menelaus was part of that pact. But I can't get a read on why Agamemnon is doing this. And maybe you have a better read on it than I do. But Achilles just thinks it's very I think it's for Achilles is very personal in my mind. At least in the battles that are happening in this.
Yes. What was the pact that you were saying?
So I believe, if I'm getting the story wrong, let me know. But when one of the reasons that Paris kidnaps Helen, who is the wife of Menelaus of Sparta.
Oh, so you're asking why is Agamemnon there at Troy?
Why is Agamemnon? Because the other kings of Greece had made pacts. I think it was essentially around Menelaus marrying Helen or something. I don't know the exact details, but long story short, it's kind of like the World War I alliance thing where one of us gets hurt. All of the other ones are going to come in and back him up.
Yes.
And that's why they all sail to war. So I'm like, is Agamemnon there out of obligation? And that's the only reason he's there.
Yeah.
You know, I guess is that part of the way his character acts?
Interesting. Yes. So definitely, you're right on there. And it was also a way to maintain peace.
Yes.
After Helen chose, but after the suitor was chosen for Helen, mm-hmm. Because obviously someone's going to be upset and then there's going to be a war. So it's basically this pledge. Menelaus was not there when this whole contest went down, but Agamemnon was there to represent him. Mm-hmm. So I think that could be potentially a reason. I would also say that there are a lot of mythological or narrative fictional implications about all of this, but more realistically, Troy had control over a strategic point in the Strait of the Dardanelles.
Mm.
So that made them very powerful economically and strategically. So this would also be a good thing to try to wrest control of. So I think that there's also that sort of thought. So there's probably honor as well as greed being wrapped up in that. As, yeah, his character motivations. Well, yeah, he certainly doesn't want to lose. But I feel like his honor's not as much at stake compared to Menelaus.
Yeah.
So for Agamemnon, I think it's got to be something other than Helen. Mm-hmm. I think he uses Helen as a reason, but I think it's something far deeper.
Kind of maybe an ambition or something.
Yeah. Yep, and his Kleos. Yeah, for Hector, I love Hector. I think that he is... I definitely would have a crush more... I do have a crush. I have a crush on Hector more so than Achilles. I love that Hector's a family man and that he seems to actually love his wife. And that scene with his son where his son starts crying when he has his armor on and then he removes his honor and everything. But I think you're right that he's definitely fighting for that city. And there's... a theme of military glory to a certain extent over family because he has to, you know, say goodbye to his wife and she's like, no, please don't. He's like, I must. But that's the, I think the contrast between, I don't know if you could potentially call them foils of each other, maybe. I don't know if it's perfect, but Achilles is kind of self-centered and I think he doesn't realize what a community actually is. Whereas I think Hector does understand what a community is and what is at stake in this whole thing. And he seems like a generally kind, even when he's killing people, he seems like a kind person. I don't think that he hacked anybody's heads off. And, you know, he tried to make that pact with Achilles and Achilles turned him down in regards to, you know, treat our bodies respectfully and give us back to the camps. And Achilles is like, no, I'm going to let the dogs eat your body. So you can, I think, get a sense of who these people are just from that.
Yeah,
I will lead. Yes, I'll take that and lead into grief versus anger. Do you think there's an overlap when we're in these battle scenes of a comrade, a close comrade dies and then someone is immediately they've got this action, they go after that person? Do you think there's grief or anger, or do you think it's hard to determine what's going on in those moments?
I think it's the third thing. I think that sometimes the anger is driven by the grief, certainly with Achilles, right? So, there's a sense of brotherhood among a lot of the soldiers fighting in this war. So to feel that deeply emotionally connected to the person, and then part of grieving their death is to get vengeance, right? On some level, it's a very common type of story for a war book, you know. So I think the grief is sometimes driving the anger.
Yeah, I would agree. I found those passages beautiful in their brutality. Because I think you really, whereas we're in an age now, and I think it's gotten better, where men are maybe more afraid to show their love for another man. But you really feel that here. Like, there are some really close relationships that I saw, not in a homoerotic way, but like people who grew up together, who have been comrades for these 9 years, and to watch someone be killed right in front of you. I think, yes, you have that brief time to mourn, but you realize I can't stay here and mourn and pull up my hair and beat my breast. But it shifts into anger, and then that turns into revenge.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the almost the best thing that I could closely relate it to is Sons of Anarchy, because I feel like that has that brutality there, but that brotherhood of them, like these men with machismo, but loving each other, and then if they witness a death, you know, in front of them, like Opie in front of our lead, Jack, they have those moments of mourning. I thought that this was a good question that I had found. Do you feel like Homer takes a side in the conflict?
I want to say he's on the side of the Achaeans, but at the same time, I wonder if that's only because the Achaeans do win the war, so the war is actually, the history is just shown from the point of view of the victor and not the defeated. Mm-hmm. But I'm not entirely sure if he's strongly taking one side or the other, because most of the Trojan army is not seen as evil or bad in some sort of way. I think Paris is probably one of the only notable bad guys on the side of the Trojans.
Because of sheer negligence.
Yeah.
And incompetence. Yeah. Yeah, I feel like no one's brutal over there, because Ajax, son of Oileus. Both mm-hmm. of the Ajaxes are pretty bad, but son of
Oileus.
That gets
confusing sometimes, by the way.
Yes, like little and big, I think, yeah. maybe. But yes, son of Oileus is the one you got to watch out for. Yes, I agree with you. I think knowing the result, mm-hmm. I think making a conscious choice to invoke the muse and say Achilles might lend itself to maybe some biases. But I think he fights against it, though, because there seem to have been so many books in a row where the Trojans were, you know, it's really Act Two, encroaching and like, oh, are they actually going to win because they are going to burn these ships and they make their way across the ditch and everything.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's a good balance, at least.
That's true, yeah.
But I think he does have preference for certain characters, like Hector. Aeneas pops up, I think Sarpedon on the mm-hmm. Trojan side. And Priam, I think those are pretty big.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, Achilles, obviously, and Patroclus. So, yeah, let's talk about Patroclus. Let's ask the question everyone wants to know. Did you feel like Achilles and Patroclus were lovers?
Well, I was shipping them.
Okay.
But I can see, guys, I see both sides of this. Where, like, it totally, like, the amount of passion in Achilles when he's mourning and when he's fighting, that speaks to a love, right? At the same time, it's not to say that men can't have some level of intimate relationship with one another but not be lovers, which is something that's gotten very lost in our current society too.
Right.
But yeah, there's they are certainly love to one another. What capacity you would like to say it, I guess, is open to interpretation, even though I think they were lovers.
Yeah, it's oof. If not lovers, then it's, yeah, definitely the best friend that, you know, you get matching tattoos with, that knows every detail of you. I think there's nothing overt, and I think even, if I recall correctly, Emily Wilson even mentions that, because I think people do, they want this. Obviously, we have Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller.
Yes.
And I feel like the only thing I could, besides the love, which I'll talk about, is that there's one scene where they both go to bed with their women in like the same bed, and I thought, well, I don't know that I would do that with a friend of mine. So so that was maybe the one thing that I thought, maybe. But you're right, I mean, Achilles ceases eating, he sacrifices, I think, like 12 Trojan youths. He is constant, well, he's dragging Hector's body around, like, every day around the pyre. He's doing all sorts of things, and weeping and crying. And it seems a lot. It seems like you have lost your other half if you are acting in this regard. So, because I think even Andromache doesn't act this intense when she finds out that Hector has been killed.
No, you're right.
She's definitely in a state of mourning, but this is, like, way more. So the thing that is lost, obviously, with the translation is that, man, I wish I could piece apart, you know, what actual verbs, you know, are being used.
True.
When some of these are happening. But, oof, yeah. Why do you think he ends up giving Patroclus his armor?
I don't know. Patroclus was going to go and do this anyway, so I'll give you my armor to hopefully that will protect you. But yeah, I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah. And I wonder if it was a bit of, again, maybe I was going to say guilt, but I wonder if that sense of shame that he can at least, he can keep his moral high ground by refusing to participate.
Yes.
But at least kind of this symbolism of him is alive and well. And, you know, the plan was that he was, Patroclus was just supposed to rouse the army and then come back.
Yeah.
So he did way more than his directive.
Yeah, he rushed into battle.
Yeah. We shan't victim blame. But he was going for it. But he did very well. And then a really intense and long sequence of fighting over that body, in particular fighting over that armor.
Yeah.
Significance of that. What did you think about that whole scene?
Ooh, that is, it's intense. And then it kind of foreshadows, or it's mirrored in the way that they try to get Hector's body back at the end as well. So right. There's a little bit of symmetry there in a kind of a cruel way and such. And the armor itself is symbolic, right? So the fighting over that armor is the fighting over a symbol, is the fighting over something that would be akin to something morale boosting in one way or another. So he's kind of just caught in the middle of that.
Sometimes I am amazed at all of the armor stripping mm-hmm. and just thinking, where is this armor stripping going? And culturally, this is the way to prove your kleos, in that you have to prove that you've done this. And so the armor would be the way to prove it.
Okay.
But it just gets a bit nuts because it's like everyone's stripping everybody's armor. And what are you doing after that? So this Hector obviously wears the armor afterwards. Yeah, that was, ooh, I didn't remember that from the first time I read it. Just that long, drawn-out scene of getting that body.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I feel like it's honor wrapped up in, well, I guess it's just, well, yeah, I'll say it's honor wrapped up in, I think, maybe love, because it would be kind of like a capture the flag situation. You know, you've lost this. This is a bad thing. But also, I think that Patroclus is probably pretty beloved throughout the camp, that they want to bring him back. But it's interesting when we compare it to the Hector scene, as you said, you know, foreshadowing, because his Patroclus's body is not defiled in any way.
No. And they just want the armor.
Yeah. And yet, the horrors that befall Hector's body, where soldiers take turns stabbing him with spears. And I don't think the dogs actually go at him, but that's like the standing threat. Why, I guess, is there not reciprocity to a certain extent? And I should say, another reason why this befuddles me is because they have that day of let us cease battle and let us bury our dead.
Yes.
And so I was like, that's how lovely. You know, kind of like we had ceasefires, I think. Was it Christmas in World War One?
Yeah.
But then here we have just really an atrocity, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, again, the personalness of it, it is very dishonoring of Hector. Unfortunately, we don't see Achilles' death in this, which clearly this is a repercussion for it on some level.
Yeah, no, I'm just processing, I guess, all of that. And it's, I just feel like the Greeks, so going back to the Homer section, the question about does he have a preference, it seems like more brutal events occur on the side of the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, this beheading, though I do think that Hector, like, beheaded someone in the heat of a moment, but Ajax just completely lopped a guy's head off, which was excessive, and he was already dead. And this just seems like so much, dragging his body. Yeah, I just don't know. It befuddles me, I guess, that this would happen. And I guess it points to, again, this cataclysmic rage that that grief turns into rage. So it's all coming together. And that maybe he's doing things that normally he might not. I don't know. Well,
it also fulfills what we've been doing with Achilles since the beginning of the book, which is keeping off the pedestal that heroic mythology might put him on. Yeah.
Yeah. The result, obviously, of this body being over here is that Priam is snuck over to enemy lines in order to beseech Achilles for his son's body back.
Mm-hmm.
why do you think Achilles agrees to this? Is it just as simply as I think it was Iris came to him and said, Zeus tells you to do this? Because he says that, you know, God, I was already going to, you know, God did that. Or is there something more to this?
I certainly think it's the gods pulling what they have. Perhaps Achilles' anger has finally subsided enough and he's seeing a little more clearly and a little more reasonably. Perhaps this restores some of the honor that Hector lost by having his body drag around, which is going to be very important among everybody in this war, Greek, Achaean, or Trojan.
I think, and this happens in the Aeneid as well, where Aeneas was fighting all these Greeks, and then he sees Priam and is reminded of his own father, and he's like, maybe I should go home. Because I do wonder, and even I'm on just page 599, where Priam is saying, you know, I've endured what no man yet on earth has done. I press my mouth into the hand of him who killed my son. This is when he first came. And then it says, this made Achilles yearn to mourn his father. And so I wondered if there's also a, he sees Peleus in Priam as well. And so maybe he thinks, oh, if only also my father could mourn me, because he won't, because I will be dead here at Troy.
Yeah, he even says, like, he's weeping at Achilles' feet, and then Achilles wept at times for his own father and at times sometimes for Patroclus. So yeah, I think it's that empathy, in a sense, right? That even though he's the one who did this, seeing this, he gains some empathy, and perhaps it ends the quarrel, you know? It ends the rage.
Yeah, and this is where he goes on, which I think is pretty famous, about the two jars that Zeus gives.
Mm-hmm.
One is good things and one is filled with bad things.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. This epic ends basically like that. So it does not end with the end of the war.
No.
What are your thoughts on how it ends?
So it's weird because... I was trying to think of this in a context that's more modern. This feels like a television series more than it feels like a movie. And this would be the end of a season, you know? So we have a conclusion. We don't have a conclusion to the war, but we have a conclusion to this story. And it's the story of Achilles in this regard anyway. And you know, he'll go on to die, et cetera. Some of this was very strange after, because it's Hector's death and Achilles dragging the body around, and we have Priam coming to Achilles, just like we were just describing.
Mm-hmm.
In between that is the Olympics.
Oh, like, yeah, I did forget about
that. What the heck is going on here? Like, okay, wrestling. Like, it was, and it's a custom thing. I get it. It's a cultural thing that I don't understand, but I was just kind of like, that threw me off. So the ending to this is really prolonged. Right, the falling action is just really long, and the really important part is more of book 24 after book 22. There is a certain amount of closure at the end of the book, so it's an appropriate ending because it's so personal of that of Achilles. Achilles doesn't survive the war, so why go on to show the Trojan horse, right?
Mm-hmm.
If Achilles isn't going to be there,
right?
So that might be the story. If this, that would be the next season. That would be the next epic or whatever you want to call it, right? That would be it. Would be the focus might be on somebody else.
Yeah,
you know.
Instead
of Achilles.
Sorry, I cut you off.
No, go ahead.
I wonder if it would have been too much of a cheat. Actually, one of my questions was: do you feel like Achilles was cheated from the actual honor of killing Hector because of the gods intervening? And I know that Apollo guides Paris's arrows, and so to also have Achilles die with the intervention of a god, would that be like super, I don't even know if anticlimactic is the word, but
I think it,
like,
would be a little bit
a poor ending.
Yeah, I think it would be a poor ending. I mean, we've seen plenty of stories where the hero gives a big sacrifice because the villain has been killed. Hector's not a villain, though.
Yeah.
This isn't Beowulf facing off against the dragon where Wiglaf is I think this week off with him, and he heroically gives himself to fight the monster. Or this is not Arthur and Mordred, where Arthur has to die because Mordred's his bastard son. So on some level, this is him making up for that sin, right? This is a little bit different. There's a personal beef between Hector and Achilles because of Patroclus' death, but prior to that, there wasn't. They were just simply two people on the opposite side of a war. So to have a clear victor like this and then have him go on, yeah, it makes sense.
I will say, in regards to the funeral games, I was wondering as I was reading it, mm-hmm. what the Trojans thought. Like, if you're just on the wall watching as they're doing these chariot racing and boxing and stuff. And I guess they would understand, but I'm just thinking, like, these Greeks are having a heck of a good time, aren't they? And then here the Trojans are mourning the loss of their prince, mm-hmm. and they don't even have his body back.
They're placing bets.
The Trojans?
Yeah, they're gambling on the
Greeks.
Oh,
my gosh. Yeah. I guess it's a good respite anyways for
I guess so.
It's no just, action, it, yeah.
Yeah.
Writing-wise or literature-wise.
Okay.
Use of similes. I would say that it happens frequently, maybe overly frequently. What are your thoughts on the use of the similes?
The Homeric or epic similes. Sometimes I found it comical because they kept popping up, especially like Dawn. Rosy-fingered Dawn and Dawn with her hands. So sometimes it was just like, okay, you're laying it on a little thick, but other times it was just like, yeah, this is part of the style. So it was... So it's good to see it there, you know, because it's come what I come to expect from Homer is language like that.
Yes.
So they certainly belong. But sometimes it was like, whoa, this is a bit much.
Yeah.
Every other stanza.
I know. Yeah, there'd be a dash. I'm like, oh, here it comes. Just like a dot, dot, dot. As a dot, dot, dot.
Or the other the epithet, right? The swift-footed or...
Oh, yeah.
Or Odysseus, yes. Trickster, or like somebody slayer of men, you know, like that sort of... thing.
Leader of horses?
Yeah. It was Hector, leader of horses, yeah.
Yep. One of them was like, I thought was a bad epithet, and there was actually a discussion in it in the back of the book with Hephaestus, and I can't remember, was it like dull-footed or crooked-footed or something like that?
I think so, yeah.
That's a terrible epithet. And some commentator thought, no, this is just normal, Mike. No, this is bad. He was thrown off of, you know, a mountain because Hera thought he looked ugly. So, yeah. I mean, this poor guy. Oh, well, anyways. I enjoyed them. I think, I don't know if I, maybe, could it be overuse? I mean, there were a lot of them. But I think it's only overuse, in my opinion, if suddenly we've reached the capacity where now they no longer add to what is being said, but because all of them heightened the action that was going on.
Yes.
I enjoyed it. Yeah. I think at one point Hector was compared to a deer, which I thought was very shocking. And that was kind of your clue as to like bad stuff's about to happen because he is not a predator, but he's a prey.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. So I enjoy those and like figuring out what's going on. What are we comparing this to this? I feel like those are the what I mean, there were so many questions. I think we covered a lot. Yeah. Are there any that you would like or any other topics?
Two things that always struck me. So Diomedes is all over the first 8 or 9 books of this thing. Like, it's almost like he's the hero. Or he's a pretty strong character when Achilles is not on the field. I just found that really, really interesting because I was like, I didn't remember that. And he's shown as like this really, really great, even arrogant warrior and kind of a big leader. The other one I was very interested for obvious reasons to see when Odysseus was mentioned.
Yeah.
And I knew about the night ray, but there's a lot of like him pleading with Agamemnon are like, there's arguments with them, and he is still on the battle and he's fighting and everything. It's really, really interesting. The Night Raid is interesting because it does kind of foreshadow the fact that Odysseus is the one who comes up with the idea for the horse. Mm-hmm. So the idea of espionage and trickery on his part is laid down here, which I think is really good to, you know, kind of go up and for recall when you are reading the Odyssey.
Right. Just like you did that, I was always looking to see what Aeneas was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very much, he was compared to Hector as being like one of the top fighters. So I was happy to see him. He pops up several times, but is not given like a huge amount. His fight against Diomedes is one of those big ones. And then Venus, of course. Aphrodite, of course. Dragon, yeah. I'm so sorry to all the audiences. I'm sure you understand why that's happening constantly. I'm not doing it intentionally. Yeah, you know, scurries him away. So you and I show our biases implicitly, I guess. Is it – so I watched, which I'll probably rewatch, Troy, Fall of a City on Netflix. And in it, Odysseus was the one who killed Astyanax, Hector's baby. Like, he threw him off of a wall. Is that in the Odyssey? Is that a true thing?
It's not mentioned in the Odyssey. Okay. I don't, unless I,
because I wonder where they got that, and whether he is
in the Odyssey, unless I'm mistaken. But yeah.
It seems like more cruel than he is, though he could be. He could be mean at times. But I just thought, ooh, throwing the baby over the wall, is that too much?
Yeah, no, it is a little too much. But I don't remember that being mentioned.
I'll have to do some research on that.
Yeah.
Did you have another point?
Diomedes. That was just very interesting to me. I don't really have any thoughts about like what the significance of that is. It's just the fact that I was like, I kept coming back to him.
Yeah.
And Homer kept coming back to him because Achilles wasn't there.
Yeah. I think you got to have a replacement potentially.
Yeah.
A skilled person. And Diomedes was the one who killed Sarpedon, wasn't he?
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was pretty tragic too. Yeah, Zeus really didn't want that to happen. Zeus in that way was very much like Priam.
Yeah.
I think that was the most sort of mortal and human that Zeus had been seen, when he was just really wishing for his son to make it. And then Hera's like, you dummy. He's fated to die.
True.
So any other thoughts?
No.
Okay, yeah.
I know we couldn't cover the entire thing bit by bit. No. We'd be here for 2 more hours.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, have like points every book and everything. Yeah, it's so, I in my opinion, it's just so rich.
Yeah.
There's so much to do. So I think we hopped on there or touched upon all of the big points for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite character? I guess I'll ask that as we end.
I'm leaning toward Hector.
Oh.
I do love Patroclus too.
Yeah.
And I feel really, I feel sad over the death of both of them. I don't have anything against Achilles, but Hector was an interesting character, and so is Patroclus because of their fates.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. What about you?
So you have a crush on Hector too? Yeah, I would say.
God-wise, it's probably Athena, by the way.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I would say Hector, and Hera was pretty interesting here, mm-hmm. just with her machinations.
True.
But those might be the two. And I'm just always kind of looking to see what Hera's doing anyways. I just find her very complex and interesting. But yeah, I think I just had a fondness and a strong literary attraction to Hector and how he was portrayed. And I think I go more, there's obviously a huge camp in the romances, the contemporary romances, of like morally great characters. But I think for me, I'm more like, maybe not morally great, but a morally upright person. And I felt like Hector very much was that type of person for me.
Yeah.
So, but I think that's just a bias of wanting the Trojans to win. So, and then of course the final question is this required reading?
So like, you have to know this story in order to understand a lot of Western literature, right? It's mm-hmm. it is a true foundational text of our literature. Wilson's translation is so good that I would probably say yes, especially if you're just a serious student of literature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think definitely every classicist should read this.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think just with its influence on literature, you should give this a go. And even if not the whole thing, which I know is difficult. I mean, our book, I think, was over 600 pages.
Mm-hmm.
At least, like, I think there are moments, vignettes maybe to focus on. So I would say yes as well.
Yeah. Cool. We have a good amount of feedback. Whoa. From Dracula, by the way. Okay. I'm going to run through the Facebook comments.
Okay.
And I'll have you cover the emails. Robert Ward started with an off-topic question saying that when we posted it, there was a release of a new novel called Batman Resurrection, which I believe somebody said it has to do with the 89 movie. I actually didn't know it was coming out until he pointed it out. So are you planning on reading it? I probably will pick it up at some point. What about you?
Probably not. Okay. I don't know. I have so many things on like my to be read. Yeah. that's probably not on. And I, you know, Batman literature is not necessarily where I tend. If it was like a Batgirl, then yes, but probably not that.
Ryan Daly chimed in saying he's also revisiting Dracula for the Halloween season, but he's actually listening to the audio version narrated by Tim Curry and Alan Cumming, which sounds delightful. Jonathan Schaefer Hames said that Maggie and him are also doing that, and he was going to ask Stella if she wanted to be on with them to talk about it. You were like,
"I had no idea what was going on."
Yeah. So then Robert comes in and says, "How have you never read Camilla?" Audible has a really good first full cast version too. I will say that within the last week or two since Dracula came out, that episode, I have read Camilla.
Okay.
It's not very long. It's like, I think it's I got the PDF off of, or I got the downloaded book off of Project Gutenberg. And I think it was like about 100 pages or maybe a little bit more. Uh-huh. This is not a very, very long book. And I actually did enjoy it. It was very, very interesting. It was very, and in places, yes, very kind of a little bit of eroticism, but it was still Victorian England. But it's still the whole lesbian eroticism aspect of it. I can totally see how people are like, "Oh yeah, this is that." And then there's the Andy Warhol's. I've seen Andy Warhol's Dracula because I caught it on cable once.
Oh dear, the bad cable.
What?
The scandalous cable.
Yes, it was scandalous cable. It was, there was a lot of nudity and a lot of humping. Yep. The line from the movie that he quotes is, "The blood of these whores is killing me," because he needs the blood of a virgin to survive or whatever. And so these daughters of a noble family, he's preying on them. But the problem is that they're faking their virginity for their father. Meanwhile, they're doing the deed with like the farm boy or whatever. And yeah, it's a weird, weird movie. But it's funny because he's getting poisoned by their blood. And he also recommended a few adaptations and pointed to a cleaned up YouTube video of one of the adult Dracula films.
What's cleaned up mean, you think?
The sex taken out. He also mentioned Stella about the Iliad, was telling her how he was going to read it before the show starts. Yeah. He never said anything about, but he had an inkling that she would choose it as her birthday month book.
Yeah, that's unintentional, but yes, it worked out.
Yeah. Apparently there is a captain of the Demeter en route to the Count Dracula, to England with Count Dracula board story by Sylvia Moreno Garcia on a novella called The Route of Ice and Salt. Sounds really interesting. And then, one other comment from Robert, and then I'll get to Jean's, is a long lost Stoker story has been discovered and was never referenced in bibliographies. And he linked to an article, and I read the article, and it sounds fascinating. And they're going to like read it for the first time around Halloween in Ireland. So like it had been published in like a periodical and then just forgotten. I was like, "Oh, that's fascinating." It was a fascinating read. So if you go on our Facebook page and look at the Dracula thread, he posts a link to it. It's a really, really interesting read. Gene Hendricks said that his preferred adaptation of the story is the BBC Count Dracula miniseries with Louis Jordan, killing it as the Count. I see what you did there, Gene. It's as close to the novel as any version I've found, with just a couple of obvious changes. Lucy and Mina were sisters. Sorry, Stella. Oh. And they combine Arthur and Quincy into one character. Van Helsing, played by Frank Finlay, is just excellent. He's straight out of the novel.
There could be incest.
Yeah. And then we have two comments on our website. One is from Captain Entropy, and the other one is from Alexander Osias, I believe. I'm pronouncing his name correctly.
People are coming out of the woodwork for this episode.
So Stella, you're going to read these two.
Oh, okay.
to end the feedback section. Thank you.
Yes, Captain Entropy here. Stella, if that doesn't ring a bell, we ate pizza together once as part of a Heroes Con crowd. I do actually remember who you are. So thank you, though, for orienting me to that, because I had to think about why that name sounded familiar, but I remember us being at the edge of the big group. I hope to meet you someday as well, Tom. I really enjoyed the discussion of Bram Stoker's Dracula, and I have comments. Pacing. I first read the novel on a Barnes & Noble e-reader, Nook. It was a classics edition. It was a classics edition Barnes & Noble had put together with every old-timey reference or place name linked to a glossary at the back. I loved it. It was like reading the annotated for the 21st century version. It informed my reading without slowing me down. I was going through some interminable pre-deployment training run by the U.S. Army. I spent three times as much time waiting on my instructions to get their stuff together as I actually did training. So, by comparison to how slow my life was at this point, the novel was paced just fine. Technology. One of the notes they made in the classic edition was that, as Tom pointed out in his comparison to 90s computer movies, Stoker was packing the novel with as many modern references as he could. Even the typewriter Mina used was only 30 years old at the time of publication. According to the commentary, Stoker's readers considered themselves denizens of a scientific age beyond mysticism and hoodoo. Stoker was telling the readers they were fooling themselves. The old ways and the darkness still had power, even in the modern age. I think the Romani segments are part of Stoker's repudiation of arrogant, uninformed modernity. The primitive, superstitious people of Transylvania are, with the exception of the open-minded Van Helsing, the only ones with the knowledge to even slow this monster down. Van Helsing is really the only one equipped to navigate both worlds. But the whole novel is designed to induce fear, to tell the readers that the science they place their faith in won't save them. I think the sexual aspects are similarly manipulative and commercial. I don't mean that in a bad way. We pay novelists to manipulate our emotions. But Stoker's equivocal stance on sex is his way of eating his cake and having it too. He titillates his audience with vampire-induced wantonness, but he avoids condemnation by saying it wasn't their fault. The devil or one of his chief minions made them do it. He also makes sure the symbols and sacraments of Christianity have real power over the darkness. That might be consistent with his actual worldview, but it also prevents people from railing against his novel. It's like how, in the original Ocean's 11, spoiler alert, they weren't allowed to get away with the money. The movie makers could show crime as fun, but they couldn't let it pay. I think the two of you were spot on regarding where the novel fits in literature, not required reading for academic reasons, just for cultural significance. I enjoyed it, though. Thanks again for the great discussion.
And then there's Alexander's comment.
Who's Alexander?
Alexander Osias, who's Amosias, was the WordPress name.
Oh.
You want to go ahead and read that?
Oh, okay. I wonder if, are you from England? Because of the hello. Hello, Tom and Stella. Got the link from Cap and Entropy. Oh, look at this. This guy's just spreading it around like the disease that Dracula's spreading around. Anyway, vampirism. Dracula caught my eye, and I checked out the backlist of episodes to see that some of these are among the books I'm trying to get my teenage son to read, and some that I have read already myself. We'll be posting again soon on this and other episodes once I'm caught up. Look, we have another friend.
Yeah. I hope to hear from other episodes about other episodes. That'd be interesting
100%.
To hear. Yeah.
Oh, is that it? Oh, yes, am I supposed to leave us out?
Okay. Yes.
Thanks.
That's why I gave you the last email.
Oh, I see. Well, Tom, we've come to that time in our evening where we shed our old clothes and put on our new clothes. So what new book will we be challenge to read for next time, which may I say is, again, Tom doing me dirty. So this really, when I choose the Iliad, is getting him back for all the holidays that he gets every year. So he has once again Christmas. So Tom, what are we doing next time?
Well, this is a challenge because we've read three books about Christmas, or two, a play and two books. We read A Christmas Carol, we read Ethan Frome, we read A Doll's House, right? And I like really, really having a hard time finding novels that were like really, really schmaltzy or cheesy. And I was like, I really don't feel like reading that sort of stuff, right? So I finally went into nonfiction, and I was like, okay, we're gonna do something a little bit different. We've got three things lined up, and they're all essays. Okay. And I have the file. I will post a link to the Google Drive folder where I'm keeping the files if anybody wants to read them, even though two of the three of them are available online because they're in the online easily. One of them is called A Child's Christmas in Wales. It is by Dylan Thomas. The second one is called A Christmas Memory. It is by Truman Capote.
Whoa.
And the third one is called Duel in the Snow, or How Red Rider Nails the Cleveland Street Kid by Gene Shepherd. They're all childhood Christmas memories from famous authors. So it'd be interesting to take a look at this sort of idea of a Christmas essay or Christmas memory being shared. Why they're so well known and why they're so famous, and common themes among them, and those sorts of things. So it's a bit of a comparative literature piece. Each of them is not terrible. I think the Gene Shepherd piece is a little bit long. It's like maybe 20 pages out of a book, but the other two are not terribly long. So it's significantly lighter reading this time, and it all is Christmas memory stuff. So A Child's Christmas in Wales, A Christmas Memory, and Duel in the Snow, or How Red Rider Nails the Cleveland Street Kid will be our next episode. And until then, take a breath after reading this book. Maybe go read Song of Achilles or the Odyssey or something if you ever want to pick up the Greeks again.
Yeah.
And thank you very much for listening, and take care.
Yeah, and be sure when you're picking up those boulders to throw them at your mortal enemy, to lift with your knees.
Yes, yes. You don't want to throw your back out.
No.
Okay. Good night.
Goodbye. Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.